This is episode 11 of IDRA Class Notes.
Rather than assuming they're a bunch of lazy know-nothings, assume that if you are a blue-collar family, you have three kids, and you're a single parent, you're hanging on by your fingernails, and I need to first admire and let the world know, hey, you're surviving. Because there's people with $80,000 a year that are not managing to survive, and you, with very little, you're buying the groceries every week, the kid comes to school wearing clothes, bathe, you know, in other words, like, you are doing a lot.
Welcome to the IDRA's Class Notes podcast. You're listening to Josie Cortez. If you're a regular listener, thank you for coming back. And if you're a first-time listener, this is a podcast for people who care about making sure every single child in our U.S. public schools has an excellent and equitable education. The Intercultural Development Research Association, IDRA, has been deeply committed to making schools work for all children for over 30 years. And to do that, we value what the language and the culture that children and families bring. IDRA knows that schools can and do change, but not on their own. For this reason, family involvement has been an integral part of IDRA's work from the very beginning. IDRA has always recognized that parents can be their children's strongest advocates. And we bring together families and others in communities across the state and the country to be a strong voice that protects the rights of all children to an excellent education. The person who's been leading IDRA's work in parent involvement is Aurelio Montemayor, IDRA's lead trainer and director of our Parent Information and Resource Center. Aurelio brings over 30 years of experience and expertise in working with schools, communities, families, and students. He's passionate about the power of parent and community engagement for leadership development and effective education, and he's a key developer of our model for parent engagement and in helping schools, parents, and community groups rethink how they work together. Aurelio, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Josie.
And Aurelio, let's start off this podcast with some of your ideas and reflections over the past more than 30 years, really, of what has been most significant in working with parents and schools and in making sure that our topic for today, valuing families in children's education, really happens in schools.
Well, Josie, I started teaching high school English in 1964. As a young teacher, I had been given no information in my training, in my college education, about the role of parents or parent education. And so as I started teaching and then reflected after my first 4 years of teaching on my experiences, I realized that I had acquired or adopted certain attitudes towards families that didn't mesh with my upbringing in my community. I realized I was looking at parents as if they were somehow childlike or to blame for what I saw as the problems kids were having in my classroom. I was arrogant. I was also a bad teacher. I was very proud that I flunked over 60% of my junior English students, and I was praised as being a tough teacher in those days. But the truth is that I had picked up a way of looking at community that somehow enthroned me as teacher and as a source of good information from students. And anything or everything that somehow made me be less of a good teacher was to blame for my not succeeding with the students. And there was a lot of collusion from other educators and what was being said about families is that families themselves are to blame, especially blue-collar, working-class, minority, non-English-speaking families. Families generally weren't doing enough, and since they were sending me unprepared goods, their children were not prepared for my excellent teaching, it was obviously their fault. I went through some huge changes and some radical changes in terms of how I saw myself as a teacher and both how I saw myself as a teacher of high school students and how I later on saw myself as a teacher of adults. As hard as it was to rethink how I saw the learner, because in the late 60s, early 70s, I was studying the works of Paulo Freire, Malcolm Knowles, and others. I started realizing that in shifting my view of adults, because then I was teaching other teachers and trainers to work with adults, I had to shift how I saw the learner. It didn't quickly just carry over to see how schools were seeing parents. I still would accept or collude with attitudes were basically a deficit model. There's something wrong with those families that has to be fixed. And because there still isn't a strong base in college teacher preparation or administrator preparation that counters that. And this paradigm shift is the biggest challenge I see in our parent work.
So after 30 years, you still see the same phenomenon? You see the same things in schools on how educators see families?
Well, sadly enough, yes. There's a parallel. You'll have people who are professional development experts, or at least present very often, who give lip service to participation of the learner, for example. And you'll have a thin veneer of participation, more symbolic, but really very little respect for what the learner brings, the experience of the learner, whether the learner is a teacher, a PhD, or a housewife that has limited education. Still, there's at least a conscious move, at least on the surface, within teacher education, for example, to make it more participatory, more experience-based, and to validate the learner's experience. Less than 3 weeks ago, we were conducting training of trainers in a major, major school district in the state, and had about 20 people going through training of trainers. And these would have, I thought, be representative of best current thinking and practice. And as these people in the workshop were preparing their workshops for parents, what my colleagues and I started seeing is that they were looking at the parents in all the ways that we wanted to counter. For example, I listed in our model, and I've talked about it before, we have four major levels or dimensions of parent participation from the point of view of the parent.
And this is IDRA's?
Yes, this is IDRA's
leadership model. Mm-hmm.
And it's in parallel to and maybe somewhat in contrast to the major six keys that Epstein and others use, which are very good, but they come from the institution point of view. So when we see parents as first teachers of the children and parents as resources to the education of their children, parents as decision makers and parents as leaders and trainers, our four dimensions, I still 3 weeks ago was hearing this. Parents do not know how to rear children properly. This is the assumption that is verbalized or not verbalized, but is present. Parents have limited knowledge because of their limited formal education. These parents are poor because they do not have initiative and don't want to work. I mean, it doesn't mean that parents are perfect and some of these problems aren't present. It's just that these assumptions is like a thick layer of that. And to cut through that, they're listening to us, listening to me, and agreeing with my valuing assumptions. For example, in contrast to the ones I just gave you as deficit assumptions, we say parents have already taught their children many things, irrespective of their class, race, anything, whether they're PhDs or don't know how to read and write. Parents continue to transmit values, beliefs, and traditions to their children. And parents demonstrate their love for their children in a variety of ways. These are just some assumptions that I had to take on if I'm going to work with parents in supporting their role as first teachers of their children. These assumptions already imply, on the negative side, the deficit, that my activities already have an underlying set of assumptions that mean I'm looking at these learners, at these parents, as something broken that has to be fixed.
And that's particularly the case for parents that are minority, that speak a language other than English, or who are poor. The perception that those parents don't care about their kids is still quite prevalent, as wrong as that perception is.
Well, yeah, and sometimes you could say, let's say, oversimplify, say it's racism. In other words, it's a person who's not a person of color saying that about a person of color. I wish that was universally true. But one of the really, why I use myself as an example of having had to shift in my first 4 or 5 years of teaching was because I grew up relatively poor on a border town. Spanish was the first language in my home. And by the time I was a teacher, I had already put on the mantle of the institution saying, I am better than these children. My English, I have more command of the English language and blah, 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 blah. Somehow Spanish is an interference for them and on and on and on. I've been in the presence of a young lady who is like the assistant to the assistant to the secretary, who comes from a South Texas migrant farm worker family, who probably, this is her first paying job she got, other than picking crops. I walk into this small school, I'm wearing a suit and tie and a briefcase. She smiles at me and said, yes sir, can I help you? Assumes I'm good and important because I look professional. Coming in the doorway with me is a middle-aged lady in a simple dress who is from that community and comes in with body language that shows she's respectful and maybe a little bit afraid. The same young lady who was treating me so courteously turns around and with a frown on her face in Spanish asks her, ¿Qué quiere? What do you want? The real client was that lady. I might be a drug pusher for all she knows, but that's why I say it's not racism. It's this, you put on the mantle of the institution, and the mantle of the institution is a set of deficit assumptions. And you hear it. If we don't feed them, they don't come. Okay? Or make the kids perform. That's the only way they're going to come. And blah, blah, blah. And then, and you'll have Latinos say that about Latinos, African Americans about African Americans, poor people about poor people. It's just that's the way it shows up. Therefore, you'll have activities that they say, we need simple, practical, hands-on activities. That's the best we can do with these parents. Or they need a class on how to raise my child for success. Oh, or how to get and keep a job. You know, all the assumptions, you know. It's like, I was working with a group recently who was saying, we need to give a workshop to these parents to have them know how important attendance is in school of their kids and have the kid not be pulled out, yanked out before the school day is over. Well, I'm sure that some parents abuse that, but a typical group of parents doesn't need to be told it's important for the kids to be at school. What you need to know is what were the circumstances that caused the child not to be able to come, and how can we support you so that that is reduced? In other words, rather than assuming they're a bunch of lazy know-nothings, assume that if you are a blue-collar family, you have three kids, and you're a single parent, you're hanging on by your fingernails, and I need to first admire and let the world know, hey, you're surviving. Because there's people with $80,000 a year that are not managing to survive, and you, with very little, you're buying the groceries every week, the kid comes to school wearing clothes, bathe, you know, in other words, like, you are doing a lot.
So how do you get people to recognize the assets and the inherent strengths of families?
Easier said than done. The problem is sometimes, the thing about a paradigm, it's like somebody described it, it's like if you have an artificial lens adhered to your eyes. You're seeing through this lens of a particular color and you think everything is that color. How do you remove the lens? Because it's kind of a shock when you realize I've been transmitting these very limited ways of looking at human beings. So we have a card game where we have parents spotted really fast, educators have a little bit more problem, where they contrast valuing and deficit assumptions. And it's sometimes they'll say, oh, yeah, I agree with this. And then when you say, but how can I get 30 people into my next workshop? Rather than thinking about how do I establish trust in a relationship with some families, it's more, I've got to get the numbers in there. If you're a Title I parent outreach worker, well, you know, oh, God, you know, I don't know what subject, you know, do I have door prizes and da-da-da-da, and what can I do to make sure they come to my meeting? Paradigm shift is said easily, and it's for the last 30 years, it's on everybody's tongue, but it's really a very serious and difficult change. How long did it take for women to be acknowledged as potential voters in this country? Or children to be stopped, looked at as little slaves that you could hire and work? You know, they were part of the working population for large families. How long has it taken to see that buildings need to be adapted to the needs of people rather than people that are in wheelchairs have to figure out how to go up long steps? I mean, it's not an easy thing. And part of it is the shock when you realize, my God, I've been transmitting. I'm not perfect myself. And I'm sure I'm transmitting some set of notions to people that I'm unaware of. Precisely because I'm unaware of, and I don't like to think of myself as somebody who's prejudiced, but obviously I am. But in the world of schools, it's still so easy to hear the broken record from parent leaders who become the elect few saying, we are here, where are the others? You know, they don't care. Those single ladies, you know, all they care about is having a good time. And you just hear all this stuff come out of people's mouths. You hear it in a teacher's lounge. You hear it at a parent meeting.
So in all these years, what caused the shift for you at the beginning? And what have you seen that has caused a shift in educators?
Well, for me, I think it was a very personal path. There was a very strong emotional moment in my life when I realized that I had been ashamed of my father. And this happened in this way. I was an only child. My dad was from Mexico, and he was a brilliant man. His accent in English was interesting, but he taught himself English by doing crossword puzzles, so he was just like a walking dictionary. In fact, my mom and I used to call him El Diccionario. And I remember when I was an undergraduate at a small private Catholic college, sometimes my roommates or friends would want to come to Laredo because it was their chance to go to Mexico. And some of the kids there came from different parts of the country, not close to a border town. And I remember later on that I had felt embarrassed about my dad's accent. Somehow, society prejudice had instilled in my head that I spoke English without a noticeable accent, and my dad had a very noticeable accent, and this was cause for embarrassment to me. Why, I'm not sure, but when I realized that, I started realizing I had to revisit where I came from, my roots, and everything that was valuable in them. As I was doing that, it was very easy for me in working in the community, because I became a VISTA supervisor trainer working all over South Texas, and I was working with people similar to my family, to my extended family. And it was so easy when I no longer thought as a professional to communicate, to listen, to have them bring out their stories, their wisdom, without romanticizing it or in any way glorifying it. I mean, it's just that is what is. And many years later, for example, a guy in Arizona and some other researchers talked about the funds of knowledge and looking at the knowledge in the community. Well, that's when I started mining myself. It was part of me re-evaluating what it meant to be a successful professional, but especially successful within the field of literature and the teaching of English and as a writer and all those other things, and still somehow remain a very strong, rather than, there was a young man whom I went through a similar path and came out of the other side, I call it an embarrassment of riches for myself. In other words, I don't have any feeling that I had to leave my culture. In fact, when I reconnected to my roots as being working, a working class family, where Spanish was co-equal with English, where the street in front of my house was not paved until I was already a teacher, that in all that, there's power, there's intelligence. And in fact, as a teacher, if I don't draw on it, that means that I have to erase or ignore the major part of a human being's background and experience and start from scratch. And it's like, then you really start with a blank slate, and it's hopeless, you know? Mm-hmm. So I found that in my work with adults, in my own communities, and later on as I rethought working with kids of any age, was that as a teacher, the most efficient, in fact, the most rich way to go is the valuing side, whether it's Freddy talking about a critical education and the process of creating a concientización. It's not really a conscious, but a critical way of looking at the world, or the principles of andragogy that Malcolm Knowles and others talked about. In the research community, there's all kinds of battles about what it means and doesn't mean, but the truth is that my experience in the ground as a teacher, and I've never stopped being a teacher, just my students changed, it's become much more efficient for me to use the valuing assumptions that we label valuing, just like in our program to increase the school holding power. We realize that rather than label a kid at risk, you value that student as a possible tutor, it's the same shift. Rather than looking as a student as a throwaway or as a problem maker, you're saying, no, this student is a potential leader, tutor, can contribute tremendously to children and to this community.
Can you point to a school or a successful experience where you've used the parent leadership model?
Yeah, quite a few. I'll give you a few examples. Let me just say, first of all, think of parents, Spanish-dominant parents, some recent immigrants, presenting interdisciplinary projects at a high school. Think of students teaching parents how to use the internet to get educational information. Think of families, teachers, and students engaging in dialogue. And think of parents and students testifying at hearings. I'm going to give an example for each of those. On the first one, interdisciplinary projects, there's a high school, small high school in Houston, Eastwood Academy. Dr. Rogelio Lopez is the principal. And for 4 years in a row, this particular campus, it's a public charter school. And in their charter, they wrote it to be a project-based school. So the way they've done that is every semester, students present interdisciplinary projects. They choose a theme and they present. And the tradition had been for the first few years of the school was that parents were invited to the student presentation at the end of the semester. And that was it. As we started looking at more in depth, and I was using the Parent Information Resource Center resources to enrich their parent involvement, we said, well, let's not just figure out how to get more parents here for the event, but how can parents be co-presenters and co-developers of projects with students, as long as they can do it in Spanish or English? And for 4 years, we've had parents presenting in English and in Spanish their own projects around the themes. And the themes have been heroes and villains, have been when I'm 23, a variety of topics. And the parents have been extremely creative and energetic. And like a lot of them saying, I'm glad I'm coming back to school. But it's, again, looking at the parents not as just invite them to see what their kid did, but as intelligent and creative human beings. And they've been that. It's been very successful. A different one came from, we've been working with some community organizations and schools in South Texas, where a lot of the parents are limited in their ability to use technology, and they're English language learners. But we know that from generations up without end, for parents that are English language learners, the students, the children have always been the language bridge. Years ago, I know that when families from South Texas, including from Laredo, from my hometown, would go up north and they would get in these trucks with a big tarpon back, the kids would be the ones that would stop and get the hamburgers at the different places where they would stop because they could manage, they could, you know, go into the store, buy the bread or whatever, and they were fluent in English and they were the language bridge for families. We've known that for a long time. Well, we started thinking, how can we get parents to get online to see the information that exists about schools? Because that's become a huge source of information. It's been a very liberating way that families and community can get a better sense of where their schools are, what they're doing with all the no child left behind requirements and everything else. Well, up to now, it's been the middle class families that have had most access to that information. And for the most part, it's to select which community they want to live in because they use it as a, let's go to this suburb because we like the properties, it's close to work and the school, da da da. Well, I think for poor minority and working class families, it's a very different issue. They are where they are. It's difficult for them to move, but they need to know how their school is doing. So as we were trying to introduce the families to what's online, and because children were always present when we did these parent meetings for parent leadership, we invited the students to help us become the bridge, and they became the technology bridge. So you have students and families and adults engaging in using the technology to get online. And, you know, we had some ladies for the first time send an email. And in Spanish, sent an email. One lady sent an email to her principal because the email address was online for her elementary school's principal, where she sent a request. First of all, when is the next site-based decision-making committee meeting, and can I be on the committee? This is beautiful because it's giving access to parents in a way they couldn't before. We still have the dilemma that there's very few computers in those neighborhoods, so we help try to create a community center where there's computers available and stuff like that. But again, it's not just, it's parents and students working together. And of course, in the Latino family, it just reconnects a bond that was already there.
So you're tapping and valuing the existing strength that students have. In this case, children have always been bilingual, bicultural translators for their parents, whether they go to the doctor's office or the bank or wherever. But in this case, they're translating into technology for the parents and facilitating that connection.
And what's really interesting is I use the technology a lot, but I'm certainly not as adept as some of these young people are because they have access every day and they're not as afraid to try new software and get online and they're on MySpace and YouTube and stuff like that. that is a continuum. And there was another project comparable to this one that we did. We were working with a middle school and a high school to help the teachers that were content area teachers figure out different ways to teach students that are English language learners in their social studies, their science classes, stuff like that. That is obviously a great need that secondary schools have. Well, the parent involvement piece we decided is working with the teachers to think through how we could have some evening dialogues where we would have some food, have supper, and then invite parents, students, and school people to sit around tables and have parent and teacher dialogues. Instead of training the parents on any parenting skills or preaching to them about what they were doing or weren't doing or what they needed to do, we had teachers talk as teachers, students talk as students, and parents talk as parents, and making sure we had enough bilingual people at each table so that the language could be bridged, and then have each table send a parent and a student to report about their conversations. Very, very powerful, and all we had to do was assume that they could do it. There were circles of engagement, and they worked well. It's been hard to get secondary schools to have the kind of outreach that is needed to convene these. The classroom teacher is quite busy with teaching and curriculum, so there still are some pieces missing to make that happen as a systemic regularity, but that it can happen, and with full respect for the teachers and the parents and the students. There have been other settings like hearings that have been held on No Child Left Behind. We've had parents, they speak no English. We have a translator that they speak at length about what they expect for their children to learn, what they consider quality education, and students too. These are particular examples about how the valuing assumption, in fact, gets translated into very concrete, specific things.
Let me ask Aurelio, because I know we're coming to the end of our time, if there's one thing that you could leave with the listeners, one key message that folks can take away with them about valuing families in children's education, what would that be?
Take a blind leap. Have total and absolute faith in these adults who potentially, as parents, are the strongest advocates for those children. That's what's going to create the alliance so that these children can succeed.
Thank you. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. During the course of this podcast, if you heard something that strikes you or that brings up a question, we'd love to hear your thoughts. There'll be details at the end of this podcast for where you can send an email or fill out our comment form online. I also encourage you to subscribe to this podcast either through our website or iTunes and other podcast directories so you won't miss a single episode. Thanks again, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you for listening to IDRA Class Notes. For more information on IDRA and other Class Notes topics, go to www.idra.org. You can also send us your thoughts by email to podcast@idra.org or fill out the form on our podcast webpage at www.idra.org/podcasts.